This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Across Australia, on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community radio stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
Kilda Road, and I am standing at the front of the National Gallery of Victoria. They've currently got a massive contemporary exhibition on, and one of the artists featured in that is one of Australia's finest contemporary painters and drawers. His name is Brent Harris. Brent, welcome to Word for Word.
Hi.
As we look at the iconic water wall here at National Gallery of Victoria, to the left is a two-story replica of one of your prints. It's quite all-consuming.
It's a painting, actually, and it is in the exhibition, so it's about a third of that size in the exhibition.
Yeah. So it's still big?
It's big.
Well, let's take us into the gallery and let's have a look at some of your pieces. We've arrived at level 3 at the National Gallery of Victoria, and it's the Robert Rayner Gallery. Brent Harris is my special guest, and he's agreed to give us a guided tour of his contemporary works that are on display here. Brent, there is quite a lot of pieces here, but this is really just a sample of what you do.
There are about 80 works here. It is in the prints and drawings galleries, but we've included maybe half a dozen paintings, most of which the gallery own. So most of the work in the exhibition belongs to the NGV, and it's either by purchase or by donation. Different collectors have given works.
And you do have a number of patrons that have been very generous in gifting work to the gallery, don't you?
Should I name?
Probably best not to name them, but it's an important part of what happens to get pieces on the wall.
Yes. The best collectors are those that buy your work in depth, as some of the collectors that have gifted my works here, and then the better collectors are the ones that will then gift works onto museums, which is the best result for an artist, you know, and it's certainly happened for me in regards to the NGV and other institutions around the country, and it's very, very, very valuable.
Now, you were born in New Zealand. Your life growing up was a troubled one, I believe.
It's so complicated. It's sort of a complicated family story, but it wasn't an unhappy, really. It was not an unhappy child. I mean, we had to manage our father, basically, but it wasn't an unhappy childhood. You know, like, there's trauma, but it was still not unhappy. You know, kids do the best they can. You know,
and kids have an amazing ability to deal with that sort of drama, don't they?
Yeah, so probably as I've grown older, I've realised the significance of damaging events. I don't know, maybe that's the thing that we do when we get older. You know, and I know from friends that a lot of their adult traumas are based in their childhood, and, you know, and they don't seem to have quite as much significance in their childhood, but they do magnify as you grow older. You know, but
I think that's because as a child you don't know any different and you just deal with it.
That's exactly it. That would be exactly it, you know. Not that I'm troubled.
You've had enough therapy through your work.
I've had plenty of therapy as well. I love therapy. Everybody should have a therapist. You know?
Now let's start with some of your earliest pieces, which have just inside as you walk in the door here. Titled, Untitled. We've got two pieces, very small pieces.
These are pastel drawings from 1987. And I think they're very interesting in inclusions here. Not that they're great works, but It's just very interesting. They're hanging beside the three most recent works, which are about 4 weeks old, but they were very fresh to make it into this exhibition. So these three monotypes from the last 2 months and these works from the last 25 years ago. And they're both surprisingly formed in a similar fashion. With these early works, I was making marks and developing a landscape sort of space that developed up out of the mark making.
Yeah.
So they're kind of restricted in their iconography. And then if you move forward 25 years to the most recent work, where the iconography is a lot more sophisticated and just a lot more, a lot richer in referencing art history.
Take us through these recent pieces, because I, of all of the stuff, these are some of my favourites. They're kind of twisted and quirky. They're very easy to sort of form what is going on in the pictures. I mean, they're pictures of men and people, but they're a little bit spooky.
It's a series called The Fall. They're monotypes. I was in New York earlier, late last year, to see the de Kooning retrospective at MoMA, and went up to Boston to see this big Degas exhibition that I think is at the Dorsay currently. But there were quite a large number of his monotypes, and it's a particular technique. You only get one image, pretty much. You can get a very faint impression, but you generally only get the one. It's not a reproductive method. So you roll this plate up with black ink and then you smudge back with a cloth or a rag of some sort. So the image appears out of where you've smudged this inked up surface. You can reapply ink and, you know, you can smudge ink back in with your fingers and however you like. But generally it's a reductive process.
And once you've created that single plate,
yes,
laid down, I guess, your paper or your medium over the top, yeah, that's it, is it?
Yeah, the plate goes down onto the bed of the press, and then you place a wet piece of paper on top of that, and then it goes through the press and it lifts the ink up off the plate, and it's a one-off. You can then take a second impression, but it's very faint, and Degas did this and would then work back into the second impression with pastels and make the most beautiful, you know, of his ballet series. And nude figure series. So, but the iconography in here, the series is titled The Fall. I had a studio in Rome at the end of 2009 for 3 months, and the idea was to go there and make a new series of the Stations of the Cross. We'll get to that series in a minute, but in this exhibition there is the series that were done in 1989, the Stations of the Cross, and I thought I would try 20 years later to redo that series, but when I got to Rome I could not. I had no idea that the Catholics owned Jesus, and I not quite to the extent.
You didn't know that?
Not quite to the extent, you know, and the business side of it, you know, like, but when you're in Rome, it kind of just smacks you in the face. I'd been to Rome before, but not in this concentrated way. Yeah. It really irritated me, and I couldn't hold on to the subject and work with it. I did eventually work with a series called The Ecstatic Moment, which was a lot more open to sort of, you know, the idea of levitation, where Christ is levitating, mm-hmm, you know, and he's held up in the air purely on the strength of his belief. And I kind of like this idea, you know, like, not that we'll ever get to levitate. So, you know.
It depends who you ask.
So in relation to The Fall, it's kind of, it's really about the absurdity of the human condition, you know, the fall of man, if you like. But it is basically about the absurdity of the human condition. In this first print here is this sort of figure that is the figure of an old man, but he has very soft edges. He's kind of, it's almost feminizing. And I think, I mean, he's bearded. He's sitting
he's
on
kinda
this
hairy
platform. He's got a hairy face, but his body is feminizing. And I think, curiously, as the male body ages, it does feminize. I don't think the female body masculinizes. But
good
so
point.
I think he's approaching the end, if you like. He's sort of dissolving into this water. Behind him are figures, but I think he's really here by himself, and these figures that are appearing in the print are probably previous conversations or thoughts or, you know, memories or whatever. So the second print is pretty much a night sort of sky filled with horrors, the demons of a dream, I suppose. It's not that terrifying, but, you know.
Oh, it's a little scary. But there's a number of key figures in the foreground. There's the old man lying down,
yeah,
but there's also the head of almost a Christ-like or God-like
figure. Yeah, it's a
kind
of a God-like figure, isn't it?
Yeah.
There are about 35 of these prints now. I'm going to keep working until I have about 70. I'm going to then put them into groups of 14 so that the series can then sit with the Stations of the Cross. Most of the state museums own series of the stations, and two institutions are already interested in a series of the 14 of these. So really, the idea of the fall, there'll be 14. It's not connecting to the 14 stations, but the subject matter connects with the stations.
There is one image that I've seen that was it sent to me in advance of this interview, of a solo figure moving through a blackened sky and moving at like a speed, and his body's almost falling away behind him. I love that figure.
I don't think he's moving. I think he's stationary. I think the world's moving.
It's past him, right.
It's happening to him. He's not doing anything. It's happening to him, you know. Yeah. So he's sort of like
blown away.
Yeah, it's blasting his hair back and pushing it, and he's still remaining vertical in that print. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love that one. Let's go and have a look at Stations of the Cross. Tell us what's inspired this series, Stations of the Cross.
Okay. Iconographically, I was working in these very messy pastels, very colourful, and I felt that it was, I don't know, maybe a bit soft cock or something, you know? I wanted to toughen up my... As a young artist, I thought I could... So I thought hard-edge abstraction.
Strengthen the imagery.
Yes, you know, and I was looking at a lot of more difficult abstract artists like Ad Reinhardt, Barnett Newman, and their work is still difficult, you know? Barnett Newman, Jewish artist, New York artist, did a very famous series called The Stations of the Cross, which are on permanent display in the National Gallery in Washington. His reduced aesthetic and just the reduced pictorial language he used impressed me enormously. So Barnett Newman's imagery, not imagery because there's no imagery in his work, but his abstract interpretation of this subject interested me, and also Colin McCann, the New Zealand artist, who did many works numbered up to this series of 14, and generally they refer to the Stations of the Cross. His work is very religious, and there's two paintings hanging next door, actually, we could have a look at. They've just bought one of them. He uses a lot of religious text in his paintings, and yet I don't believe he was religious. Mm. And I think
he... And you're not.
No, I'm not religious either. So my engagement here, 1989, friends of mine were dying of AIDS. I was 33, the same age as Christ when he should die. Friends of mine were dying, and I'm thinking of what is a narrative that is there in place already of this passage from life toward death. And this is certainly it, and this is the passage of a young man. Christ's 33, he's condemned to death in the first station, Christ before Pilate, and then the entombment, he's buried. So they're quite abstract, very reduced, but for me the iconography in these abstract works still relates very closely to the narrative of each print. You know, Christ before Pilate, there's a single figure standing in darkness. Christ takes the cross, there's sort of an off-centred cross. But my engagement with this story really is more psychological than religious, as in Christ falls three times. So it's number 3, number 7 and number 9. And in my prints, there are large paintings for these prints as well, for this series. There's this sort of foot shape that appears in each 3 of these prints. Each time he falls, his ego is reduced to some extent. Normally when people grow old, their egos are reduced by the frailty of the body. You know, you grow weaker, your ego becomes reduced simply by managing, you know, a decaying body, if you like. Mind decays, whatever. But for a young man to face a death sentence like this, how is he going to go to death without screaming, you know, kicking and fighting? So each time he falls, his ego is reduced just a little bit. You know, so this is my reading of this.
You have a deeper interpretive understanding of the story for someone who's not a religious man.
Yeah, I suppose I do. I mean, I have thought quite long and hard about it, and even at the time I became very engaged with it. The fifth station, Simon helps carry the cross. There's a cross form here, and it's sort of supported by these. And so someone helps someone carry their cross. So, and we all do that. We all carry the burden of each other's death. You know, we carry our lovers, the burden of our lovers' death, you know, our family's death. So it's all loaded into this rather abstract stories.
You've travelled the world doing much of your learning and your artistry, and you spent some time in Singapore.
I had a residency there at the Tyler Print Institute, which was set up by Ken Tyler. He used to own Gemini Press in America, very significant press. He did all the paper pulp works with David Hockney, you know, the biggest Splash series. Canberra owned a lot from that period. Anyway, all this machinery, this amazing machinery, is Ken Tyler sold to Singapore into this workshop, so they are now able to make these large paper pulps. So I spent most of my 5 weeks there working on large paper pulp works. There is one here in the exhibition. And then at the same time, you're working with this whole workshop. So there were six printers in another section of the workshop wanting to do something. So they pressured me. So I had to come up with this idea to activate these other printers. So I decided to work on this set of woodblock prints. And again, the subject matter is religious, but it's my engagement with it isn't really religious. And there's an image here of Buddha, Jesus, and Ganesha. And when you're in Singapore, you cannot avoid the incredible colour, you know, of the Hindu temples, and the, you know, just around the corner you will come upon a Buddhist temple. I'm not sure that the Christian churches are so colourful, but they're present, you know. So, and then there are mosques. So all these religions are on this tiny island, all working together. You know, my comment really was a visual one. It is a very colourful kind of mashing together of these different world religions. All in this one place. So very colourful, and these prints are very colourful, and, you know, each dealing with a different deity, I suppose.
And these are woodblock prints.
They're woodblock prints, and they're in the jigsaw puzzle technique, which I've used a couple of times before in other series, in a series of three prints from the Grotesquerie series and a series called The Untimely. And that technique comes from Edvard Munch, where you have a block of ply, you imprint your drawing on that, and then you cut around sections of your drawing that you want to be in a particular colour. You undo the jigsaw. So it becomes
a jigsaw
puzzle.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
So the red area is rolled up or coloured red, and then there might be a blue area, and then you put the whole thing back together as a jigsaw puzzle, put your piece of paper over it, and then put it through the press. It's a very... Edvard Munch sort of devised this technique.
It's a great one.
As a simple way to make coloured prints. You know, whereas generally if you want to make coloured prints, each time you go to a different colour you need another plate, and
yes,
the registration has to be dealt with, as in these little woodblock prints here.
And then you risk the colours not being exactly what you want when they're overlaid and all that sort of stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Although this, in 1999, I had a residency in Japan for 3 months to learn the Japanese woodblock technique, which is ukiyo-e technique. So it uses watercolour. Again, maybe everybody's aware of the ukiyo-e, the absolute masterpiece. You know, the fine degree in some of them are incredible. When you realise how the technique is, it's an easy technique to learn, just an extremely difficult technique to master, you know. So they can teach it to you, but you wouldn't, you know.
Very few people get to that
yes,
brilliance.
You know, like Ujimaru, yeah, you know, and Kuniyoshi, and some of the great ones, you know, the astounding masterpieces in world art and in this technique. But that again, it's a water-based, there are seven prints in that technique here in the Grotesquerie series that I printed myself. Mm. But each time you want to go to a different colour, you have to go to a different block. So again, it's about registration, and it's a very time-consuming process.
The Grotesquerie series has one hell of a backstory. Would you like to share that with us?
Oh, I suppose it... I don't know if I'd call it one hell of a backstory.
It's certainly your interpretation of a very personal issue.
Yes. Look, quite a bit of my work is generated from strong personal emotion. So, but not all the work is generated in that way. You know, like the Stations of the Cross. The iconography is not generated from me as much as, you know, from that story. The Grotesquerie is a personal story. It's a family story, you know, about a slightly sort of fucked up family history, you know, difficult father.
Your commentary in these pictures of your father is fairly damning.
Well, he was a bastard, you know.
Yeah.
He was a child molestering, violent man, you know. I didn't cop all of his abuse. My sisters suffered more than I did, but I sort of... which had happened with me, and he was quite, you know, aggressive with all of us, I suppose. He is represented in this series through this masked, sort of hooded figure, and I put him through his paces. The series is...
You sure did.
Well, one image here, in one of the prints, there are large paintings that relate to all of this. There are 26 large paintings in this series. There are three series of prints, which the NGV own all three. There's this large painting here, one of the 26, that I think is about to be gifted by the collector of this work to the gallery. So there are 26 large paintings. There are paintings that relate to all of the seven little Japanese woodblock prints here. I say Japanese, just in the technique.
Yeah.
One of them here, I've cut his throat, and he's bleeding the family, if you like. These two childlike images drop down in the red, and the mother is reaching up in the rather anguished up through the red. There's another image up here where I've kind of pushed a dummy into his mouth. The mother is generally present as this yellow-haired, female figure, her breast often appears. There's another image here where the father figure is, to me, exhaling this sort of scrotum and breast-like form, quite fluid.
And this is a form that recently was misinterpreted by a reviewer.
Well, yeah, Robert Nelson reviewed it in The Age and referred to it as fellatio, but it's not about anybody sucking anybody off. It's about
blowing out sexuality.
It's about him blowing. It's an image. If he was to blow out a sort of a frosty air, and his sexual desire was to be imaged in that bubble, if you like, this is my interpretation. So it's neither male nor female. It's scrotum-like, it's breast-like, you know, whatever this man's sexuality was. You know, I don't know much about his what makes a person like that, I don't know. There's another image here of the mother figure alone, but she's not alone. He is still present in her hair. There's a mask forming in her hair, so the father figure is still present.
Sort of ever-present in the back of her head, so to speak.
Yeah. There's another one here where he's not quite present, but there's this sort of silhouette, this line that suggests the shoulders. So he's present as this looming figure in the background. There's another smaller work here where there's kind of like this profile, buttocks and back and head of a figure entering, and I believe this to be myself, if you like. Where I had cut his throat in a previous image, it could be here I am penetrate, like it's almost could be fucking him, if you like, in the head, you know, like that's probably over interpretation, but in this print I'm entering into the side and sort of forming it up against him, and then there's a following image that's not here where the figure is leaving, the same figure is leaving the other side of the picture. Yeah.
My guest is Brent Harris. His exhibition is on at the National Gallery of Victoria at the moment. It's on through to the middle of August 2012. You're with Dean Beck on Word for Word across Australia on the Community Radio Network.
Word for Word, delve into the extraordinary lives of everyday people.
Word for Word, challenging, inspiring, engaging and entertaining. Broadcast live on Joy 94.9, Sundays from 11 a.m. and supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you are listening to Word for Word, Dean Beck with you and my special guest today, coming to you from the National Gallery of Victoria, is Brent Harris, and we're going through some of his works. Brent, we're standing in front of a series called Troubled.
It's actually, that one is titled Troubled, but it's from a larger series called Appalling Moment.
What's appalling about this?
I had a studio in Paris for 6 months in 1993-4 through the Australia Council. When I was there, I was working on these quite abstract, pure sort of abstract images, just in drawings. And was so irritated by the good taste in Paris, and I really just wanted to sort of muck things up. So I focused on an artist called Mike Kelly. He's an American artist. He just committed suicide, actually, late last year. Anyway, just the idea of mucking things up. So I was working on these things, and then in one of the drawings, this elephant shape appeared, this head of an elephant, which was totally ridiculous, and it was ridiculous of me to allow this to remain in my work, which had been reasonably seriously abstract and formal. So I identified this as the appalling moment, my appalling moment, and then continued to make these kind of slightly playful, weird sort of figurative paintings. And I think it was a very valuable time in the end for me in Paris, because it did open my practice up just to let it become a bit kookier. So this little series relates to that.
Now, one of the things that is very evident in much of your work is the eyes. Tell us about why the eyes are, I guess, windows to your soul.
Look, it's a mystery to me. It comes up subconsciously. Like, they just keep coming up for me. And sometimes I can focus on them quite clearly, as in this series titled The Untimely. And there are, I think, about 10 paintings in this series. These ones look particularly beaky birdish, but it's very much about the gaze, the eye, that intense kind of... This is like a bird of prey almost, like this... You know, and that's, again, I think it's about the father's gaze, the gaze of the father. And as children, you know, you sort of devise strategies, but, you know, you sort of try to avoid this... the threatening gaze. If you can stay out of this person's gaze, you know, you have a greater opportunity of remaining unharmed, you know. So the Untimely series very much is about the gaze of the father. And these two do look like beaky birds, and I guess you could read them as birds of prey, if you like.
In the middle of your exhibition, there is a piece that's not yours. In fact, from a very famous Dutch artist.
Norwegian, sorry. Edvard Munch. And it's a work, when I was at art school at VCA 30 years ago, 1982 to 84, the art school was at the back of the NGV, and we had very good access to the gallery and the collections, and I was always impressed by Munch and accessed the prints. And this very famous print, Towards the Forest, he is using this jigsaw puzzle technique here. Iconographically, the thing about this image is the dribbly way the sky meets the top of the trees. And this large screen print of mine here called To the Forest, the Munch work is titled Towards the Forest, and I've taken, you know, my inspiration from this dribbling, forming form at the top of this work into my work, which looks like sort of snow-covered conifer tree, if you like.
It does a little. But there's also something very interesting in the fluidity of the figures and the play on the positive and negative within the two figures in the foreground.
Yes, that is also an element that comes into my work. I really love the embrace, the tenderness of the embrace in this work. And this kind of shape, the positive-negative shape, plays into the large painting, the large black-and-white painting here called Swamp Number 2.
Which is the one that is featured on the front of the gallery as you enter from St Kilda Road.
That's right. There's a black shape in the centre of this painting, so the white figure bending over, but there's an isolated, floating, dark shape which then becomes a positive form. And for me, this refers back to... not really refers back to the Munch, but it sits in a very similar place to the way that sits on that surface.
Now, this swamp figure is part of a huge series of yours, both paintings and prints.
There are 17 or 18 large paintings in this series, and a set of two screen prints, large screen prints, and this set of seven aquatints here. And it's pretty much about the body and the forming of the body through the fluid, or through the fluid. They're very swampy, if you like.
They're also very sexual, I have to say.
I don't see it, do you? No, I don't... for me, it was very much about the body forming. I mean, there are appendages, rather large appendages in the works, some of them, but... it's rather about the forming of the feet, the body forming out of fluid, if you like.
And how many of these pieces are owned by the gallery?
Well, they own this set of seven aquatints, and the two screen prints have been gifted to the gallery, and the large painting which they purchased in 1999.
That's the one that, as we said, features on the front wall of the gallery as you walk in. Now, as we come to the conclusion of your exhibition, we've done the full rounds. There is a very large green painting with what you describe as a womb.
I've never thought of that until I've seen the painting hanging here. It's from 1996, and it's from a series called On Becoming, and I was very much engaged in reading... French theorist called Gilles Deleuze, and one of his titles, one of his essays or segments in this large work of his called A Thousand Plateaus is called On Becoming, and it's just, I guess it's just the becoming of form, my reading of it. This is kind of like the ground zero of becoming form, so it's just large floating cream lozenge, I suppose, on a green field. And I hadn't actually thought of it as being a womb until sort of standing in front of it here. But it could be. But it's kind of like it is as reduced as I could take it back to. And then the series starts to form from here. It then moves into sort of strangely more figurative and head-like sort of shapes.
Now, as we've been walking around today, we've watched and amused by some number of people that have come up to this particular painting and just stared at it and discussed it at length. And you seem somewhat bemused by that.
Well, it's pretty. It's a kind of a dull painting. Like, it's not dull because it's very colourful, but what is there?
There's not a lot to it, is
there?
No,
there's not a lot to it. Yeah. But it does seem to interest people. And I think it's optically kind of curious, and you had quite a good description.
Look, I find that it pulses. Because it's so flat in its texture, the brightness of the green and the cream seems to sort of pulse in and out. I don't know what it is, but every time I look at it, it's moving. So maybe that's what other people are seeing in it, but you certainly don't.
No. I don't. For me, it's more of an intellectual play on becoming, I suppose.
The curator of Brent Harris's exhibition is Jane Devery, and she joins us now. Jane, congratulations on an amazing expose of Brent's work. It's just beautiful. What goes into putting something like this together?
Firstly, thanks very much. It's been a real joy to work on this one. Working closely with Brent has been really enriching, and yeah, it's been a lot of hard work, but it's all been fantastic. So really one of the interesting things about this exhibition is that it's drawn almost entirely from the NGV's holdings. So Brent's one of those artists that we've been collecting in depth from pretty early on in his career. So I think the earliest work in this exhibition dates from 1987, and we've got things that are straight out of the studio. So it really covers about 25 years, so it's interesting in that way.
How does the gallery earmark an artist like Brent to follow over their career and to really get in at that early stage? Because you did. In 87, he was a virtual nobody to become one of Australia's finest. How do you know when you're onto something good?
Well, that's the challenge, obviously, for any curator of contemporary art. And I think this exhibition and our holdings of Brent's work is really testament to the visions of previous curators who've worked here. So quite a number of curators have helped build up this collection. But it is, we look for artists who show promise at a young age in their career and at a young point in their career. And Brent enjoyed early success, so, you know, within a few years of graduating from the VCA in Melbourne, he was really attracting a lot of critical attention. So I guess we were noticing him at that point and continued to follow him as he kind of rose in prominence.
Contemporary art tends to get a bit of a bad rap quite often, and for many it's very difficult to see how one could invest in imagery that is not a clear narrative. How is it that you can find such beautiful pieces like these? I mean, having Brent walk me through some of them today has been a huge eye-opener for me personally, but you must have to fight off this sort of criticism all the time.
Yeah, it's certainly one of the challenges of being a curator in contemporary art. I find that as a really interesting challenge to be able to present material that at first glance might not be easily understood, or, you know, a lot of people have a lot of fear about contemporary art, but I think it's one of the roles, particularly in institutions like the NGV, is to try and break down those kind of fears that people might have and
to educate us Philistines.
I'm not saying that. but to make it accessible, because it's there for everyone's enjoyment, and, you know, we all own this work too. It's a state collection. So, and I think Brent's work is very beautiful. I mean, some of the subjects are quite difficult, but they do draw you in. Particularly the new works are incredibly vibrant and colourful and seductive, but equally, you know, the earlier, at every stage in his career, his works have been characterised by quite a strong aesthetic and this really seductive quality, I think. So I think most people will allow themselves to be drawn into that, and, well, I'd hope so anyway.
He's very prolific. How do you pick and choose which ones that you want featured within your gallery walls?
Well, that was difficult because we do have more works than are in the exhibition. And he's a prolific artist who works in large series of works. One of the things I wanted to tease out in this exhibition was the quite complicated relationship that he has, his drawings and his printmaking practices have in relation to his paintings. So I was looking at a balance of works, so that was one way of kind of narrowing down the list. But, you know, obviously looking at key works from different series was another way, just to get an address, kind of a balance of the main modes that he's worked through, I suppose.
Now, you've put together a wonderful little book that accompanies this exhibition. Congratulations on that, because it really does help the viewer get a greater depth and understanding of Brent's work. It forms part of a much larger exhibition of contemporary works for the National Gallery of Victoria. Can you tell us a bit about that bigger picture that's going through this year?
So this is one of a number of contemporary art exhibitions that we'll mount this year. Coming up later in the year, we'll be mounting an exhibition of contemporary art, again from the collection, entirely from the collection, all works that have been acquired through a particular fund, which is called the Victorian Foundation for Living Australian Artists, and that's kind of one of the next ones on the horizon.
This is also free to come and see, which is lovely.
We try to make it as accessible as possible.
And that's partly because it's our works, right?
That's right.
What are some of the highlights of this exhibition that you're particularly proud to have the gallery own and exhibit on this round?
Well, I think everything in here has got its own richness, but I'm particularly excited by the new paintings. There's three small new paintings that you see as you enter the exhibition space, and they represent this quite dramatic shift in Brent's painting style that occurred over the past few years. They're quite beguiling little works that are...
They're my favourites too.
Are they? I'm not surprised. But there's also, I was very pleased to be able to include three very, very recent monotypes that are kind of straight off the press, so to speak, in Brent's studio. And they kind of have evolved out of the recent paintings, and it's just wonderful. We've actually got them hanging next to the earliest works in the exhibition, so you can see really these dramatic shifts that have occurred over a couple of decades.
Jane Devery, congratulations on curating an amazing exhibition of Brent Harris's work, and thank you very much for joining us on Word for Word.
Thank you very much.
Brent Harris, it's been an absolute delight to meet you today, and it's been great to get a deeper understanding of your work and how your work has progressed. And it's deeply personal, clearly. Some of it's psychological.
Yes, I think intellectual, psychological and personal. Quite often works are generated by from strong emotion, and then you sort of come out the other end of that. And I think the most recent work now is probably more universal rather than personal. You know, the subject of the fall and the absurdity of the human condition is more universal than just my situation. So it kind of moves around. It's very curious in an exhibition like this that I, as the artist or any artist, gets to see the past or the time laid out, you know, in this curious way, and whether it stacks up or doesn't stack up.
You hold your own here very, very well on the walls of the National Gallery Victoria.
It is a great opportunity. You know, it's been great working with Jane Devery. She's done a great job at installing this, I think. And it's really informative for an artist to be able to look back over the work. So I'd be curious to see what happens next.
Congratulations on this exhibition. It's going through to 12th of August, and it's on at the Robert Rayner Gallery here at the National Gallery of Victoria in St Kilda Road. Now, Brent Harris, where can we find out more information about your works other than coming here to the gallery?
Well, my two galleries, I show in Melbourne at Tolano Galleries, Sydney at Martin Brown Contemporary, and in Perth at Lister Gallery. They all have websites that contain my work, but I'm just started putting together my own website. So it actually, I'm going to work backwards. So I've put up the two most recent exhibitions, and I've also put up the Grotesquerie series. So there are 26 paintings. So they're all imaged on the website now, which would be hopefully interesting for people. And then slowly as I add to that, I'll start introducing text and other information. And it's, I think it's just brentharris.com.au, I'm not sure.
We'll check on that.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome.
There'll be a podcast and a transcript of this interview available for download from Joy's website, joy.org.au. If you'd like to correspond with the program, please do so. Simply send an email, wordforword@joy.org.au. I'm Dean Beck. You can follow me on Twitter at Dean Beck on Air. Till next time, you keep well, take care, and bye for now.
Word for Word is produced by Robert Brierley and presented by
Dean Beck
from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9. Word for Word is made possible thanks to funding provided by the Community Broadcasting Foundation and is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations in the Community Radio Network.
Joy 94.9 is a GLB TIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.